Good morning, Teachers on Fire. Welcome back to another edition of the Teachers on Fire podcast. I'm so glad that you're here with us, whether you're joining in the live show or on the replay. I'm glad to have you here. Today's Teacher on Fire is Josh Ogilvy. Josh is an experienced teacher, presenter, and educational consultant from British Columbia, Canada. He is also an international assessment associate with Solution Tree, a large publisher. Josh has worked with many teachers, schools, and districts across North America to dive into and explore complex topics in education, such as assessment, grading, and communicating student learning. Follow Josh on X at JoshOgilvy4. Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to light it up?
I am. Let's do it.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about your current context in education? What does that look like for you right now?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'm currently teaching in the Sooke School District, which is a suburb of Victoria here in Vancouver Island, British Columbia, Canada. I'm teaching at a local secondary school. It's a community school, which is great because we get to share the school with the community and we access the community. New to this district after moving here, as I mentioned, and just really loving everything that I'm seeing, just the energy, the excitement, the support for how we're moving forward. It also happens to be one of the fastest, if not the fastest growing district in the province. So there's lots of new exciting opportunities coming and just this really tremendous sense of growth, which not only professionally speaking, but also physically as the cities and the towns and the schools are just popping up everywhere. So that's a little bit about where I am, just loving life right here in the Sooke School District.
Well, as you know, Josh, I am over here on the Lower Mainland, so I'm a little bit biased. But for those not familiar with the area, Josh may be in one of the most beautiful parts of the country for sure. Southern Vancouver Island is just glorious and a little bit more sunshine, I think, than we get here on the Lower Mainland.
Yeah, my family's in Vancouver and there are days I'm like, oh, it's a beautiful sunny day here. And I'm like, what's that out your window? Oh, look at that rain. That sucks.
Josh, let's start out with story time. Would you mind sharing a story of adversity that you've faced in your teaching or education journey and describe how you overcame it?
Yeah, you know, there have been many. This is year 21, so there's definitely lots of those. But I think one more than any stands out when I think about adversity. It was when I was teaching in a previous school district and I came into a new school. I was a department head at a previous school and I came into a new school. And when I went to meet the department, I sat down. It was really awkward. I sat down. There's a big table in the middle of the office and just everybody else is around the edges doing their work. And I'm sitting there and no one's talking. It's really awkward. And as they all come to the table to meet, before I can even get my name out to them, say, hi, my name is Josh. It's great to meet you. One member says, like, we've been together for more than 10 years. Nothing you can do is going to make us change. And I was just like, I haven't even told you who my name is. Now, a little bit of backstory to that is I've worked with the development of the new curriculum here. And so apparently there was some sort of reputation, which was not true. But anyway, there's a perception of who I was coming in. And that whole first year at this school in the role was, no doubt about it, is the most challenging year I've had professionally. Like there were people going behind my back, trying to manipulate scenes, trying to get me removed from position, trying to get things done. They were talking to students, giving them false information about what I was saying and trying to do. And I'm just trying to get a fit. Like, who are these people? How can we work together? And no matter what I tried to do, it was just stonewalled everywhere. And it was pretty exhausting. You know, some people that I knew in administration roles would ask, like, how are things going? How are these new initiatives going with the department? It's like, I can't even get a word in edgewise. I can't say anything without lots of hesitation and resistance and negativity. But it was funny enough, it was one of the things that started to turn the tables was we're doing an activity in our class one day and the kids were like screaming for fun and like more. And we had an open gym, two open gyms. And one of the teachers came up afterwards and was like, what was going on in that gym? Like, what was happening? And I explained the activity and they're just like, I want to see it. So the next day I redid it. So they come and see. And then that teacher went and tried it. And they had a very similar experience. And it just goes to reinforce the ideas like when teachers can experience something positive, they're more likely to kind of move forward with something or embrace something. And it was more than the activity. It was that started a small relationship, right, with that one person. So I had a way in to like even talk with somebody. And from that, it just kind of steamrolled to other people hearing about the idea, trying it, and then opening up to, hey, what's possible? Because when I started there was a lot, it was a very traditional system. They had these norms kids were categorized by, and the practices about assessment and grading, just if we can call it that, it was just in September, it was known who was going to be ended in course with what grade. But with the end of my 5-6 years at the school, things had drastically shifted, completely changed. But it was really that first year was one of the lowest moments for me. I actually considered moving into administration because I wanted out. Thankfully, I never got the position for administration because it was absolutely the wrong reason to go. But for me, I was like, I can't survive this way. Something has to change. And thankfully, it was really starting to make that way in with a few people, develop a relationship, and also finding different networks for me. I couldn't just be surrounded by negativity all the time. So you might remember when Twitter chats were a thing. That's when I started doing Twitter chats and I met a lot of people. I got involved with some provincial organizations and national organizations. I just really put myself out there to try to connect with different so that what I was experiencing wasn't my reality.
What a great story. I like a couple of takeaways there. One, the Twitter aspect. Of course, you know I'm on board with that. I think it's a great idea to reach outside of your building and connect with people who share your passions and understand your mindset, perhaps. And then I also admire the fact, Josh, that you stuck it out. You didn't jump ship, like you said. And sometimes that incremental growth and change and building relationships over time actually does pay off. And I think maybe that story can give hope to someone out there who's on a similar journey. Well, Josh, let's talk about PE, or in BC, we like to say PHE. That's the way that the ministry is asking us to refer to it because we're putting health right with physical education. How have the new curriculum and reporting orders changed instruction and learning in the subject? I know this question is way too large, so take it wherever you'd like. But just in the bird's eye view in the last decade, let's say, how have things changed?
Yeah, great. And it's something I remember working on the curriculum. I worked on the writing team and then was seconded to kind of lead the development of it. And there's a lot of hesitation just with the name. And I won't give the story, full story here, but there was a lot of time spent on what will this be called? There's definitely a global shift to kind of elevating. I'll say elevating meaning bringing up, not in terms of priority or importance, but you're going to find some jurisdictions will call it PHE or HPE or HNPE or PENH. Like health is in there somewhere. But yeah, it's, I think the biggest, if I could summarize it in the most articulate way, would be to say a lot of historic practices in PHE, PE, whatever we want to call it, tend to focus on what are we doing? What activities are we doing? Traditionally, what sports are we doing or what games? And those are kind of seen to be a destination and end. And they're going to do a whole lot of things to learn how to play these games with the hope that the kids will find something that they're going to like for the rest of their life. And we know that doesn't really happen, but that's a different story. I think with the biggest shift, this is these activities are being looked at now. Hopefully people are seeing them more as a vehicle to arrive somewhere. They're not the destination. They're being used to help kids learn about stuff. And I think this curriculum is really trying to emphasize or highlight that kids are supposed to be learning stuff in our classes, right? And there's a lot of things we can be learning, but we just can't leave it to chance. There's just way too much at stake in terms of our schools to leave learning to chance. So it's by design, there's some things we want kids to be learning. And then we're going to use a variety of activities, appropriate activities to help kids engage in these learning activities, excuse me, and then move forward. Which we can't say traditionally that's been the way. Also, I think one of the bigger shifts is, and there's still a lot of resistance in our field, not necessarily here in BC, but in the field of PE in general. It's when we're thinking, like the most commonly cited goal about PE has to do with something along the lines of we want kids to develop a healthy, active life or love of activity for lifestyle. We can't even begin to go on that journey if we exclude anything related to health. Right? It's not just to live a healthy, active lifestyle, to live a healthy lifestyle. You can't just say it's only physically because our physical bodies are not separate from everything else in our health, right? They're so intertwined. They're completely together. So it's really trying to look at the different aspects of health from a holistic point of view and try to understand how are they impacting each other. So for example, when I'm physically active, what does that do for my sense? How do I feel when I'm physically active? What happens to my mental state, my mental emotional state? Just as a way of elevating from the sense of use your body as a machine, which traditionally is quite a historic perspective and belief, to what's happening in the body when I move. I don't want to move today. Why? What's going on? Maybe I'm super stressed. Maybe I'm exhausted because of what's going on. What are some things I can do if I'm in that location, if I'm in that place where I am exhausted right now? And for, you know, like a lot of students in the secondary here with end of semester one, naturally going to be very exhausted because things are piling on. Same with educators. So I think a lot, like you said, this can go a lot of different ways, but I think the curriculum is really trying to emphasize what are kids learning. Funny enough, it was like years later, now we have this new reporting policy to really articulate what are they learning. I think one of the challenges we've had in our field is both the curriculum and the reporting policy have been delivered, if you will, or put out there, but there's not a lot of consistent messaging and or supports for people to understand clearly what they're being asked to do. Mm-hmm. So with that, it's, and you know, with educators and rightfully so, you're asking me to do something, but there's not a clear message how I'm going to do it. So how can we bridge the gap? And without a consistent message source or our plan of how we can get there, we have what we have, which is there's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of inconsistency in terms of what things mean. So how has it changed? Some people it has. I think the intention is to move the practices forward to really focus on what kids are learning and how they're doing. Whether that's being done, I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah, and we'll get into that more. I love the part that you discussed about the holistic nature of our curriculum, and I guess that's credit to you. I need to give you a little more credit here about actually forming this new curriculum. I think of the medical establishment, Josh, and how sometimes we hear this idea. Now, I hope no doctors are listening that take offense, but sometimes we hear this idea that doctors are trained all through medical school, through residency, to address symptoms and to prescribe and to deal with problems. And so often they haven't even been trained and they rarely speak of nutrition. I don't know if you've heard that idea. It would be similar to PE teachers addressing only movement and never talking about nutrition, never talking about sleep, all those other things. So we have a very well-rounded curriculum, and I actually want to get into that next. So my next question for you is, what is your advice to BC teachers, administrators, school districts about how they can best address the full PHE curriculum for students? And just before you answer, I want to throw it up on the screen here. So this is fourth grade PHE, and we've got core competencies, of course. They run through every subject. We've got big ideas. We've got curricular competencies on the left side here, content on the right. I know you're intimately familiar with all of this. The physical literacy strand is sort of what we think of traditionally that happens in the gymnasium. You might correct me on that, but sort of what a lot of people think of, right, in terms of PE. And then we have the healthy and active living, social and community health, mental well-being. And I like to remind teachers and educators, I feel like SEL got this huge pop when COVID came. SEL was like the hot thing in education, and rightly so. But we had mental well-being standards in place a long time before COVID. And so anyway, we have this big complete picture: mental, social, active living, and then, of course, physical literacy. So this has traditionally been broken down into PE and then health classes in classrooms. Is that still the best way to go? Or what is your advice when it comes to addressing all aspects of this curriculum?
Yeah, thanks. And it's there's lots of story behind how the curriculum got developed the way it did. But yeah, it's like, for example, we even considered not having those curricular subtitles, physical literacy, healthy active living. There was a time when we didn't have them. Much like social. The socials curriculum does not have those headings. They have little brackets about what those competencies might relate to. But anyway, it's I think the first thing is the years since the curriculum was released, draft-wise and then officially, I'm still answering questions from people like, what does this mean? And I find a lot of people tend to get hung up on either the first verb or verbs, or they look to the content in the competency and like, oh, I got to teach that thing. But I think one of the first things I'd say is be very clear on what the competency actually says. What is it that's being kids are being asked to do? For example, like when people see the curricular competency subheading of mental well-being, they're like, oh, I got to teach them about stress. And it's like, or, you know, like how many times I've had conversations with people like, where, what does this sex ed curriculum say in your PhD curriculum? I'm like, there is no sex ed curriculum. Like, where is that coming from? Like be clear on what's being said. Because once we have a sense of clarity, then we can start looking at, okay, what does this look like? And then from there, depending on what we're talking about, you might consider what's the best location to have these conversations, to have these learning experiences in. And I know a lot of PhD teachers are not getting support in this realm. Like I've been asked by in previous experiences, in previous districts I've worked in the gymnasium, you should be having conversations about sexual health. And I'm like, are you crazy? Do you know what it's like when one side of the gym dribbling basketballs or playing volleyballs or screaming with fun, and then on the other side, we're talking about consent and sexual health and things of these nature? Like, it's not the right environment. Same with mental well-being. There's some topics you're going to go into that can be quite sensitive. So you need a safe environment. And I say safe in terms of like being able to focus on the topic. And some of these topics can be very triggering for students. Even entering the gymnasium itself can be quite triggering for some students. So we need to be aware of where these locations are. And of course, I recognize depending on the size of the school, location can be a challenge. So in terms of a piece of advice or suggestion, as much as possible, consider where are some good locations that we can actually dive into these topics. Speaking of that, I know I'm guilty of this. I've done this when I was early in my career, back when we had the health and career education or the HACE curriculum. We used to bring in a guest speaker and like check it off, done. Okay, let's move on. Let's get down to real learning. I'm not anti-speakers. I think that they can provide a help. My suggestion would be don't treat guest speakers as a one-off. Maybe you're hearing the message as an introduction to a concept or content, and then you dive into it with your classes later on. Or you've learned about things for a while. Maybe a guest speaker comes in to reinforce something. But just trying not to let that moment rest. You know, and there's a lot of surveys out there, a lot of literature showing that students don't want to learn by guest speakers solely. They can be a help, but just really trying not to let that be the only course where kids are hearing about these things, because obviously if they're not there, they're not getting it. But it's also, it doesn't have any longevity. There's really no connection to it. It's like, yeah, that was fun. I didn't have to do class, but now what do I do with it? So just being mindful about how we're using guest speakers. I think there's a lot of ways we can use them. But yeah, it's really trying to be clear on what it is we're asking students to do. And when we understand that, then it becomes very clear for us in terms of what are we teaching? Right. So I hope there's some nuggets there that people can grab onto.
Well, I really resonate with what you said about guest speakers, because I think about professional development, professional learning, right? On the educator side, we hear the same complaint when it's just a some kind of speaker parachuted in. And maybe that's been you sometimes, and I'm sure you've been a big help. But educators want some kind of follow-up support. Yeah. And I know you provide that as part of your network and associations here in BC. Educators want someone to reach out to say, okay, now what? And yeah. I know our students are the same way.
Yeah,
I've got a few questions from our audience here. I want to say hello to Naila. And she is saying, let's see if there's anything we can address here. What do the children need to know? And sometimes one topic can cover many areas. And then she adds, absolutely look at things and topics that could trigger children. Thank you, Naila, for joining us, and thank you for those comments. I'm going to keep on going, Josh, and ask you this question. I know it's another big one. What are your thoughts on deducting grades in PE for things like attitude, effort, participation, or preparation? So traditionally, or historically, in some schools, we won't say any local schools, but traditionally, we know that there are schools out there that have derived a great portion of their assessment simply from these aspects. So my concern there is it almost becomes a compliance class and not very connected to the actual physical literacies that we're trying to teach, but simply how well did the student obey. Now, there is a standard, let's see if I can put it back up on the screen here, that I think provides an interesting connection. This one, develop and demonstrate safety, fair play, and leadership in physical activities. So I'm kind of asking a couple of questions here, but I'll start with the first one that's on the screen. What are your thoughts on deducting grades for all of these intangibles? And then what's the connection with this standard? Maybe it's fair to do some assessment in some of these areas. I hope my question makes sense. So why don't you take it away?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a hot topic. And I think one of the first things I'll say is let's get out of the binary thinking in terms of if I don't do it, then it's not going to be valued. Attitude, effort, participation, preparation, all those sort of things, very important. Every aspect of life. Right. So to not use them for grading purposes or marking purposes is not saying they're not important. It's in terms of that stuff. There's lots of research to show the little bit of research on assessment and grading in PE. Lots of it will show when teachers are left to subjective assessment. So without having clarity and alignment with the curriculums, without just whatever they want to do, lots of research will show that the teachers will favor those who are most like them in terms of their attitude. Do they like the activities? Are they playing hard? Are they skilled? And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, those who are least like them will also get the focus. And a lot of kids are lost in between, right? So obviously we want kids, it would be ideal if every kid likes what we're doing, but that's just not ideal. But that doesn't mean we have to reduce their marks. So when we're thinking about these things, if we really want kids to understand how their attitude, how their effort and participation is impacting them in the class, if and when we throw that in to how they're doing with their learning, we lose information on both. So we have no idea how either is doing. We might know it in our head, but in no way can we communicate that. By keeping them separate, we can actually say, hey, here's what you've been learning. Here's how you're doing. We've got some evidence information about this. But also look over here. Here's how things like your daily behaviors, whatever we call them, learning habits, work habits, whatever we want to call them. These are the things you're doing on a daily basis. How do you think they're impacting each other? You know, here in BC, that's a question that when teachers are wondering, how can we look at implementing our core competencies? That one question can target a lot of them. How are your learning habits impacting your learning progress? But if you don't have that information, then it's a very abstract question. The other thing you might hear a lot of PE teachers say, and I've done this before, is it's a participatory class. My diplomatic comeback to that is every class is, but participation just looks different here than it might in a traditional sit down type of classroom, but you still got to participate. So I think the big thing is really trying to focus on is yes, these things are important, but we're not compliant, our behavior compliance teachers. We didn't go to get our undergrads and become a professional educator so we can modify behavior in this realm, in this context. There might be classes for that, but this isn't that. When we get to this type of competency, this goes back to my last answer about what can we do to support people is being very clear, like what does this one competency say? It says develop and demonstrate safety, fair play, and leadership. In order for students to understand what this means, those have to be unpacked and contextually so. So if we're going to be doing certain types of activities, what safety looks like if we're playing some type of game in the gym is very different than if we're doing an orienteering unit, right? So whatever context we're in teaching kids, we need to unpack, here's what safety looks like, right? If you're doing fair play, what does fair play look like? And leadership, and I've done a master's in leadership, it is this term that has no official definition. It's everywhere. So let's clarify. As Brené Brown says, clarity is kindness. So let's clarify, what do these things mean? So when kids are being asked to develop and demonstrate them, it's not show up on time, have appropriate strip, be nice to each other, and help me clean up the equipment. Those things, those are different, right? But a lot of times those get thrown into this develop and demonstrate safety, fair play, and leadership to like, yeah, there's a connection there. So I'm going to use that practice, how you're behaving daily, and I'm going to use marks as a caveat to get you to do this. And if you don't, I'm going to lower. It's just this practice that really reinforces the notion of who has power and how is power being used in that environment. And goes back to, like we said earlier, like if our goals are to try to help kids find a sense, a connection to how they're moving, yet we're reducing marks, like we're harming in a way, this connection that they could possibly have. So it's just really, again, I don't want to get too far off tangent on this, but being clear on what we're asking kids to do And I always say this too, like if you weren't there and someone was filling your class, how would they know learning is happening? How would the students know? And the more clear we are with what kids are learning and how they're doing, we can swap people out. And then it's just like, okay, I see what's going on in this class. Let's go with it.
I like that connection with learning targets, Josh. I like it a lot. And I really appreciated what you had to say about separating these things. And I should be clear when I say deducting grades. And of course, I'm saying that from within a proficiency scale, mindful that only the senior grades really have percentages and letter grades still at this point. But I like what you had to say about separating those two, being as clear as we can. So there's the assessment that happens in the physical literacy spaces, and then we can report, we can still report on attitude, effort, participation, preparation in another section of the report card, right? In other means of communication. And like you said right at the top, it's not like these things don't matter. They matter a whole lot and they can be reported, but we're making that separation between the learning and the curricular standards. Maybe before I leave this one, and forgive me if you covered it, but let's say you've got a student out on the floor, you're in the gymnasium context, they insist on ridiculing and being very unkind to their classmates in a game. Does that take away their, now let's talk proficiency language, does that take away from their proficiency level in terms of leadership in physical activities?
That one's the gray area. It's okay. If you're focusing on that, from an assessment lens, the first point of contact or intervention would be, hey, I'll use an example here, Tim. Tim, come on over. You know, when we talked about leadership, here are some things we've been talking about that people are demonstrating. How are you doing with this? And you could give some feedback. So you kind of do an informal self-assessment. And then as a team, I could provide some like, here's what I'm noticing, right? So if we're going to evaluate your leadership skills today based on this one experience we have, where do you think you would be? So you're kind of using some clarity to intervene versus saying, Tim, stop being a donkey, right? or stop doing that. Well, what am I doing? Of course, you're probably going to have that personal connection. And if it's ongoing, then yeah, you can report on what you're seeing, but more than likely, this is a behavior issue. And it's not to say behaviors are not going to impact learning. You can't separate learning from behaviors in terms of, like, we're not just robots who just go out and do, and there's no behavior piece. But you really got to draw the connection to it. And if it continues, then you likely have some sort of school policy that's being violated. And if your interventions as the educator aren't working, then you escalate to next steps, whatever the next steps might be, contacting home, counselor, eventually administration.
Right, right. You sort of handle it in very similar ways that you would in other subjects.
Absolutely.
Last PHE question here, Josh, is kind of a practical one. Let's say that hypothetically, there's an elementary vice principal out there who just might be covering one grade 4 PHE class right now. What are your suggestions for how new PHE teachers can report on these standards? What are some practical tips? Do you have one or two in terms of, like, do you have a clipboard handy at all times? Do you do some video recording? How do you collect evidence in the context of the gymnasium? I find that such a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, again, this is a question that could be a topic in and of itself. I think when we're looking at things, I think from an assessment point of view, we want to do no harm. We really want to make sure that assessment is supportive of students' learning. And historically speaking, I don't know about your experiences in school, but probably pretty similar to what many of us who are now find ourselves in educators and older. We used to go do like 10 units. You'd be introduced to a couple skills for a game, and then you do some sort of skills test. You get the grade and off and move on to the next one. But no one can develop in that such a short time period. Like you're basically being rewarded for what you're coming in with. You might make some incremental changes, but to say that you've grown and developed your skills over a 10, 12 class unit, it's just not going to happen. Like the amount of intentional time to develop those skills, it's just not feasible necessarily in a full year for a PhD class because you've got so many kids and a teacher's attention span just can't go to one. So my first suggestion would be if we're looking at like developing movement skills, let's keep the focus on developing and focus on a few key ones that you're going to space out through the year. It's not like you got to teach them 30 different skills because that's never going to happen. You're not trying to inundate them, overload them. So focusing on where are the students, let's have a couple of key skills that we're going to focus on throughout the year. And it's not to say those are the only things they're doing, but it makes it manageable so that, you know, we're going to work on, I don't know, focusing on some skills like throwing, catching, kicking. I'm just using those for example. All right. Now just think of, if you had these criteria about how do we develop these skills with these, what does success look like? And then in classes, when they're practicing these skills, the criteria is known. As the educator, you don't need a clipboard all the time. A lot of students will, their performance will be impacted by the clipboard because the feelings of being judged. Most of the feedback we're going to give is likely going to be verbal, and that can be very helpful. Especially if you're looking at, like, for example, throwing. If I'm looking at your follow through, I don't need to write that down on my clipboard. Hey, you know what? You didn't follow through. Just transfer that weight a little bit, you know, and here's what it looks like. And then off they go, they're redoing it and they're trying again. So I guess what I'm saying is, it's just being clear on what are they learning? What does success look like? And then the verbal feedback is going to be so impactful because you don't have the clipboard. And you can if you want, but you don't have, not everything has to be recorded. And a lot of teachers, I know there are some jurisdictions in across the world where they have to enter daily marks and all these sort of things. Thankfully, here in BC, we're not one of those. So we get the benefit of really embracing the power that assessment can provide to give that feedback to help kids move forward. In terms of what skills to focus on, it really, this is the challenge we have. It's you really want to have a systems-wide perspective. So like by the end of grade one, grade two, ideally kids are here and we're not norm referencing them. They're almost like benchmarks, whether they get there or not. It's just information. I always like to say too, especially because kids don't get enough intentional practice at schools. And we know what's happening in home lives. We're generalizing here, but kids are generally not participating in the activities as many of us did in yesteryear. So many kids dropping out of sport for so many reasons. So if we're going to continue to develop their movement skills, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I question the point of, should we be assigning a grade to them? Because knowing that they don't have the time allotted to them to actually develop, what we're actually doing is grading their lifestyle. And that brings up a lot of issues for people. Well, if we're not going to grade it, then they're not going to do it. Somewhere in the school system, they learn that lesson. My kids right now are 6 and 4, and they're learning movement skills just by running around. No grades are assigned to them. We were giving them feedback up and move forward. But again, this is a complex topic, but I think one of the biggest things is just being really clear, what does success look like, modeling it, helping them see, and if we can, giving them non-examples of, well, this is not what this looks like. And this was what it looks like. And then having them practice walking around, giving some sort of feedback, letting them apply it in an authentic setting as well. I think in PHE, we do this a lot, is we'll have them do drills and then say, okay, go play the game. Where that transference between a predictable environment to an unpredictable environment might be too much. So really using some small-sided activity, small group-based stuff, applying a game-like feel to it. To develop that skill in more than you sit here and do this. Like, that's just, this is not how it works, but I don't want to get too deep into the jargon with it all, but there's really baby steps with a few. And just imagine a system where if you and I are teaching grade 4 and we know what our kids are able to do by the end of the course, whoever teaches them in grade 5, they get that information, right? And then they understand where kids are at with these skills, and they can use that to plot where they're going to be going in grade 5. And then same repetition of grade 6, 7, and so on. I know that's a bit utopic, but we can do that when we're clear, or we have a better chance of doing that.
Yes, clarity is everything. And I really like your lens that I keep hearing in what you're saying, Josh, about continuing to keep the focus of assessment on moving student learning forward. And I think sometimes we're so concerned with doing a good job and it reporting accurately. And maybe we lose sight of that a little bit, that assessment can be such a gift to the learner. We want to frame it that way in our practice. Well, let's move beyond PE a little bit, Josh. As you look around education, what else is setting you on fire today? And hey, maybe this is still in the PE realm, but take this in any direction you like. What, I know you are a busy guy. You're involved in a lot of different activities and presenting around the province. So what is on your mind these days? What is stoking your passions?
Yeah, I think it's great having my feet, if you will, in a gymnasium setting as a PHE teacher, but also in a classroom setting. I'm also teaching socials. right now. And it's really great because this is where I've always wanted my career. The vast majority of my career has been that. So I'm able to see, you know, teaching and learning from multiple perspectives. More importantly, I'm able to see students from multiple perspectives, right? Being able to see kids in a gym-based environment or outdoor-based environment or a class-based environment. And what I find what's really exciting for me, especially here in BC, is a common link between them has just been this massive surge and push around understanding assessment. But not from the lens of how do I gather scores? But from like understanding what assessment is, how it can be used in our classes to really form relationships between the learners and their learning and the teachers and the students to really move things forward. You know, it's as I mentioned earlier, I've been doing this for 21 years. And I can honestly say when I look at the landscape here in BC and even in Canada and across the world too, but our system has drastically shifted. Like I'm getting regular emails from people like, what does this look like? I've got a couple in the last few days from people in their 35 and 28 years in the field. And they're like, I want to change. And I'm like, that is amazing. I'm not going to say I'm the one who caused that, but there is movement happening. And assessment is something, well, mind you, in BC, we have reporting policies. So it's, you know, a little bit biased to say it's growing, but it's been happening for a while. Like I've been presenting across North America in assessment in PHE and in school in general for a number of years. And there's just seemingly a bigger, what does this mean? What can this look like? And I think that for me, it's really exciting because this is a world, an education that I live in. So it's great to like, you know, you're not sitting out there going, oh, okay, no one's interested in this. And even in here, you know this too, like in BC, there's so many people coming forward trying to be a voice. I shouldn't say trying, they are being a voice, a great voice in the field, moving things forward. So you can't, it's hard to hide from this now. And I know the first few years of my career, I hid from this because I had no concept of assessment, none other than multiple choice tests and true and false. Didn't understand what it was as a concept, didn't understand what it was as an implication. So I think that's one of the big things that's really exciting to me is just like, okay, like there's a need here, right? It's a professional need and people are wanting to learn more. And for me, I love learning. So this is like, it's a marriage. Like this is fantastic. So it definitely gets me really excited.
It's an exciting time for sure. Outside of education, Josh, what's another area of learning for you? I love hearing about this from different educators. What is it that ignites your passions when you leave the building and brings you alive as a human being?
I mean, first and foremost, obviously my family. But I don't want to be like, oh, okay. Yeah. Family thing. It's everything to do with my child is six. My children are 6 and 4. You know, not neurotypical. It's just so great learning about them and how we can support them as parents. As an educator, it's a bit, sometimes I'm like biting my tongue a lot. But it's great to see how they're learning and how they're doing and then how I can grow as a person. But beyond that, it's kind of going back to my last question. It's not in the classroom, so I'm going to stay on target here. But I've developed a lot of resources over the last few years for people on assessment and our reporting policy here and other things. And, a number of people I'm saying like, this is great, but I need more. They're like, if only I had somewhere to go and learn more about this. And I've had a lot of people in last year say like, you should develop a course. I'm like, oh good God, how would I do that? So I've just started recently to look into online course development. And it's really cool because I have this creative bug inside of me. Outside of school that just really needs to be tickled. And I'm finding just like looking into the background stuff and how to develop coursework. And I know it's a lot of work, but for me right now, it's just something that when I have free time, it's something where I'm just really devoting a lot of attention to look at developing because it's something that'd be exciting to have something out there and have people to engage with it. And then part of it would be like, office hours, if you will, virtual office hours to really connect with people. What does this mean in your context? How's this working for you? What might you do to move forward?
That is really cool, Josh. That's a space that I'm curious about. It sounds like you've gone a little deeper. Have you, and I might be putting you on the spot here, but have you narrowed it down to a particular course teaching platform yet, or have you not gotten that far?
I went on Udemy, I think it's called, and okay. Got a course.
I know that one.
A little overwhelming because it's there's all these things out there, but I just got one that looked like what I want to do. Low budget,
yeah.
Beginning course. And yeah. I just started diving into the first two modules. So yeah, very, very early.
Well, that is super exciting and inspiring. You've already put out so many awesome and helpful publications in the province. And I have to thank you again, Josh, just for your leadership in this space. Thanks for joining the broadcast today, Teachers on Fire. Hey, huge help to the broadcast and the podcast would be just to give this video a like wherever you are watching. Josh, we're headed into our rapid fire round. Are you ready for that?
Let's give it a try.
First question, share about a personal habit or a productivity hack that contributes to your success and keeps your fire burning. Are you a 5 a.m. wake up guy? Do you have a certain fitness ritual that you like to do? What is it that helps keep you productive?
Before kids and after kids would be a different response.
yeah.
Wearing that right now, 5 a.m., goodness no. Recently, I was listening to Adam Grant and James Clear on Adam Grant's podcast. And I mean, my God, okay. I listen to that all the time. But so much genius for those two. And there's a line that they mentioned that just really, really sticks with me. And it's reinforced like, okay, where do I want to be? And it was something along the lines of, for every action you do or every decision you make, is a vote for who you want to be or don't want to be. And as I've gotten into like being busy with kids and all the excuses we give ourselves, it's just like, I have found myself like, that is not who I want to be. And this action's a vote for who. And, you know, it's kind of an important thing in the current climate we have, politically speaking, talking about votes. So I'm just like, use that as a little bit of extra oomph to like vote how you want to vote and what you want to achieve. So yeah, that sort of hack, if you will, that self-talk, like, is this really going to be who I want to be? Is this going to be supportive of that? That one has got me back on course to be more aligned with intentional decision-making versus what feels right now.
Right. That's such a good individual. I mean, I hear that question or that frame on an organizational level, right? Like, who do we want to be? Does this align with our values? But it's a great question to put to ourselves too. Starting at Education X, in terms of social media, Josh, tell us about someone we should follow there and share why they've been inspiring you lately.
I have to be honest, I don't get on there much anymore.
Okay.
I mean, there's so many great people. Like, I love the stuff what you're doing. I'm not just trying to blow smoke here. Like, I love what you're doing. I love the space you have and what you're doing with your work. But obviously, people are here, they're following you. There's not on much. I just find it to be so gross. I go on sometimes, but it's like sometimes like, so I'm sorry, I don't really have anybody comes to mind right now in this space. I'm just like drawing blanks on it because I don't frequent it much.
Point to an ed tech tool that you currently love using in your classroom, that social studies classroom or in the PHE space. Is there something that you've been finding helpful lately?
Yeah, it's, I mean, kind of ironic given the recent statement about the school cell phone use here in BC, but maybe it's an old school one, but I like Mentimeter to get the anonymous information from kids, like word clouds. Like when I first talked to the socials kids about, you know, grading, what are your experiences? And I say 1 to 3 words, when you think of grading, what pops in your head? And it's live and kids are seeing things pop up. And I've done this with adults and educators, and I put them side by side. And the conversations you can have with these kids in the socials night class are just like, we feel the same way. Then why are these practices happening? You can just really dive deep. And even in the PhD space is a few minutes, like what's happening for you. So you can really get some great feedback and information from kids that are anonymous. And it's quick and easy to use. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, kids have cell phones. Here's a QR code. Boom. Within 2 to 3 minutes, you've got all the information you need.
I saw Mentimeter used in a workshop recently and I was really blown away, honestly, not to overstate it, but it looks so slick. Like they have really been working on that platform. So if you're looking for a way to, as Josh said, collect live feedback from your students, check out Mentimeter. One book, Josh, one that you've been reading lately or one of your all-time faves. Do you have a pick for us?
There's a lot. And I thought in the context of this conversation in PhD, one that there's not a lot out there that's PhD related. But if you think of a lot of things that have held the PhD world back in terms of being this thing that people love, Todd Rose is The End of Average, I think is a great and easy way to connect it to it in the sense of there's no sense of average. There is no average person. We really need to be mindful of the strengths that every person brings forward. And if we think of the PhD world where that's generally not the case, I know there are some champions out there, but generally speaking, it's normal, average, sorry. I really think that helps us to really shift our mindset about and looking at the kids as individuals and the strengths that they bring and everything else. And it's an easy read. It's a great read.
Hey, Josh, are you a podcast listener? If you are, tell us about one that you've got near the top of your deck and explain why you love it.
Yeah, definitely listen to podcasts, especially it's about a half hour drive to work and a half hour back. So it's a great opportunity to push the brain. As I referenced earlier, Adam Grant's, God, I can't remember the name of it, but it's got an auto dial. It's on there all the time. I've got Tom Schirmer podcast on go. Natalie Bartabasso's EduCrush. These are ones that I'm listening to regularly. I don't listen to too many, but those are three that are ready to go regularly.
On the subject of podcasts, and as a support to my work here at Teachers on Fire, who is one guest that you think I need to interview on the podcast?
I definitely think Phil Stringer. You know Phil, and the reason, I mean, he's brilliant in so many ways. Where I'm going with my thing, it's from a math context. And when I talk about assessment, math, PhD, and science tend to be ones that people, how do I do this? And I think Phil has a great, well, I don't think, I know Phil has a great perspective on this. It can really help a lot of people who considering different in math or sciences and can really articulate it so clearly. Here are some things that are doing and here are some reasons why. And it's just a genius in that realm.
Thank you for that. Phil is absolutely a great pick. And I'm very pleased to say that I've got Phil booked for a future episode. So I look forward to airing that one in the weeks to come. Finally, Josh, and just for fun, what are you streaming right now? Is there something on Netflix or Apple, Amazon Prime that you and your family have been enjoying lately?
We just finished White Lotus season 2 last night. My brother's like, oh, it's really slow and boring. We're just like, we binged the last 2 last night. Like, we got to see how this ends.
White Lotus was quite a show. Wow. Not for everyone, but that was a hard one for me and my wife to stop watching. It was, like you said, it was like, what's going to happen here? Josh, for those interested in your message, your leadership, your insights on assessment and PhE, what are the best ways for Teachers on Fire to connect with you?
It's funny. I referenced earlier, I don't go on it much, but definitely on X, Twitter. I get notifications. I just don't go on much, but there's that. I have a website out there, but I just don't update it much. That's something I'm intending to do. Yeah, those are like 2 of the big ones, definitely Twitter, X, and then the website, just interact. I do get emails regularly from the website, or just email.
Sounds good, Josh. Again, thank you so much for sharing your time with the podcast today. This has been super fun to get into these questions together with you. It's been enlightening for me, and I know I will continue to learn just by listening to this podcast long after it has been published.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me here. It was great.
Teachers on Fire, I'm your host, Tim Cavey. And once again, I want to say I'm grateful that you've spent some of your day listening to this conversation on the podcast or perhaps watching on another platform. I hope that in some way the content you heard today from Josh Ogilvy sparked your thinking and ignited your practice. And I'll meet you next week right here on the Teachers on Fire podcast. Take care, and I'll see you in the next video. Bye-bye. Even when you feel slow, you can still go. Even when there's no hope, you can still go. I never answer to no, man, I still go. Go, go.